On the 31st of August last, the Chief Judge of the United States District Court for Northern Ohio Eastern Division rendered his decision in the case of Reed et al. Versus Rhodes et al. Now, the et al. Of among the plaintiffs represented the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And the et al. Among the defendants included the governor of the state of Ohio, the attorney general, the Ohio State Board of Education, and the Cleveland Board of Education. The NAACP charged that these four defendants were guilty of actions or inactions of a segregative nature, which had contributed to the continuance of or increase of segregation in the public schools of the city of Cleveland. The judge, in his decision, ruled that the power of the governor and of the attorney general to affect what happened in the Cleveland public schools was too distant, too attenuated for them to be included among the defendants, and he excused Governor Rhodes and the attorney general. He found the State Board of Education guilty of inaction. He called their actions not unlike that of an ostrich with its head in the sand. And he found the Cleveland Board of Education guilty of actions and of inactions in violation of the United States Constitution, which had consequently deprived the children who are students in the Cleveland public school system of their full constitutional rights. Now, this decision was not entirely unexpected. Some of you may remember that 8 months ago I spoke to you from this pulpit on busing. And I suggested to you then that those who had read through the transcripts of the 31 days of testimony and the many documents submitted in evidence were by and large convinced that the Cleveland Board of Education and the Ohio State Board would be found liable for these kinds of actions. Judge Battisti's 214-page decision chronicles, details, innumerable examples of the actions which render these two bodies, in his mind, the decision of the court liable. He speaks, for instance, of how attendance districts were delineated and constructed. Tells how in the 1940s, in the Kinsman Elementary School District, the Kinsman Elementary School was maintained at 130% of student capacity, a largely black school, while two contiguous neighborhood schools were kept as they were, and they were largely white, and they were kept with less than 80% of student capacity. Perhaps the most dramatic example of the many that is cited has to do with the Todd Elementary School on the east side of Cleveland. Todd Elementary School is just north of a narrow depression of land which is called Kingsbury Run. It was a neighborhood school which drew in the 1930s and during the war years students from both sides of Kingsbury Run. There was a narrow footbridge across this ravine. Right after the Second World War, the city of Cleveland built a large public housing estate called Garden Valley, just north of Kingsbury Run. And two things happened almost simultaneously. The city of Cleveland allowed that narrow footbridge to go unrepaired and ultimately condemned it as a foot passage. And the Board of Education built a new elementary school, the Chestnut School, just north of Kingsbury Run, and assigned to it all the children who were north of this ravine, in effect creating an all-black school because this had become an all-black area, and in effect keeping Chestnut for Todd for a few more years a largely white school. There are any number of areas in which the Cleveland Board of Education was found liable. Some had to do with the drawing of attendance lines. We talk of neighborhood schools, but we forget that a neighborhood is simply a line drawn on a map. And somebody must draw that line, and they take into it all kinds of factors. And it's not unusual for school systems to gerrymander these lines, to see to it that children from one race are fed into one school and from another race are fed into another school. It's been a common practice in the early years in Cleveland and in other cities of the North. The Cleveland Board of Education was found guilty in the area of what are called relay classes, and in the area of portable classrooms, which is to say that very often when schools were becoming largely black and heavily overcrowded, rather than shifting attendance zones so that some of that overpopulation could be moved off to another school, which might still be largely or in some degree white, relay classes were established as shifts of classes, two shifts a day, rather than shift the black students off to white schools, or portable classrooms would be brought in so that the shift would not have to take place. Board of Education was found liable in terms of teacher and administrator assignments. During the early years, black teachers were kept in the black schools of the East Side and white teachers were kept in the white schools of the South and of the West Side. There were any number of examples of all of these types. In addition, there was a charge of the use of optional attendance zones, zones in certain areas in which children who lived there were allowed their option of going to one school or another, and it was shown that these zones were largely drawn to permit white children in heavily black schools to opt out and go to other elementary schools or junior high schools which were not so heavily black. On reading the evidence, there can be no doubt that given the question that was raised before Judge Battisti, he could come to only one conclusion. But it's also, I think, important to say that the evidence of action and inaction of a racist nature by the Cleveland Board of Education comes down much more heavily in the 1940s and 1950s than it does in the 1960s and the 1970s. That it is clear that in the years in which Mark Schinnerer was superintendent of the Cleveland Board of Education, there was a definite policy from the top to segregate black students and white students, to protect neighborhoods, to use the euphemism. But that when Bill Levinson and later Paul Briggs became the superintendents of our schools, this policy was abandoned and there was a serious attempt under both superintendents to make the school system as open, to make assignments as open as they could possibly be, given what they felt were the limitations of their powers, which did not extend to such activities as massive student busing. Now, this case is one of, obviously, of a long line of cases which has been raised before our courts by communities, by community groups, since the famous Brown decision of 1954. In that unanimous decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled that de jure segregation, legally established segregation of school systems, was unconstitutional. And in that case, they struck down all of the school systems of the South who had operated by what's called the separate but equal doctrine, on the assumption that they could establish two school systems, keep the races apart within the system, maintain adequate school buildings on both sides for both groups, adequate libraries, adequate recreational facilities, but still keep the races apart. And during the 1950s and early 1960s, most of the attention of community groups, of black groups, minority groups, and of the United States Civil Rights Commission was directed towards undoing the century-old patterns of apartheid in the South. But many began to look at the northern schools. And what they began to see in the northern schools was not a pattern of legally established segregation, but of segregation nonetheless. You couldn't look at any northern community and not see that there were heavily impacted black schools and schools which were largely white. This had a lot to do, obviously, with housing patterns, community patterns of that kind, but whatever the reasons, it was clear that there were racially identifiable schools in most of the big northern cities. And a new doctrine began to emerge, that was that a school system ought to have schools which were not racially identifiable. And the first case in which this doctrine was established was a case which came up from North Carolina. It began in the late 1960s. It's called Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board of Education. This school district is a large one. It comprises about 550 square miles and over 100 schools. There's some 85,000 students in this school district, about 28,000 of whom are black, and about 21,000 of these black students came from the city of Charlotte, the main town within the district. And of that 21,000 black students in Charlotte, 14,000 went to schools which were 99% black or more. In that case, the NAACP challenged the authority of the school and said the school was guilty of lack of action to remove the residue of 100 years of apartheid. And they point to the fact that when new schools had been constructed since the end of the Second World War, they'd been constructed in the heart of either black areas or white areas rather than on the fringes where they could draw from biracial communities, that school zones had been drawn with obvious concern for the racial unity of a particular school when it was established, and that teacher assignments were made with an eye to the racial compositions of the school. The federal judge agreed. The case was brought all the way up through the Court of Appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And the doctrine which came down in this case, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court and established by the local district court, reads as follows. The constitutional guarantee of equal protection demands not only a negative duty to refrain from active legal discrimination, but a duty positively to fashion affirmatively a school system as free as possible from the lasting effects of historical apartheid. A duty positively to fashion affirmatively a school system as free as possible from the lasting effects of historical apartheid. And with this decision, there began the long series of cases in Boston and Detroit and in Dayton and in Louisville and in Denver and in Minneapolis, which the Cleveland case is only our most immediate example, in which the patterns of administration of northern boards of education were attacked on the grounds that they were not examples of affirmative action to remove from a school system the lasting effects of historical apartheid. Now, in the city of Cleveland, as in Detroit and another number of other northern cities, the school board had in the last 10 years or so become largely black, led by members who often by people, as in Cleveland and Detroit, who had been officers of the NAACP. It was not a question any longer of black-hearted administrators deliberately manipulating school districts for their white constituents. But nevertheless, the NAACP in city after city has deemed it politically and legally advisable to bring actions to integrate, desegregate is a technical term, these cities, to remove from them the lasting effects of historical apartheid. In the last 15 years or so, under the last two administrators, the Cleveland school system began of its own to try to remove some of these lasting effects. There was the building of a number of magnet schools, trade schools, vocational schools, the aviation school. There was the building of a number of recreation centers sited specifically so that they would draw young people from a variety of racial and neighborhood areas. There was the deliberate attempt to see that school admission attendance zones were drawn with an eye simply to propinquity, to nearness to a school, without any eye to what group would feed into one school and what group would feed into another. But according to the NAACP, obviously this was not fast enough, it was not basic enough, and the case was brought. Now, the case itself has two parts. The first part involves a finding of liability against the Cleveland Board of Education and the Ohio State Board of Education, and that finding has been made. Now, that finding has been appealed. following a suggestion made by Judge Battisti himself. Because this case involves substantive issues of law, which there are differences of opinion, and because he felt that a quick appeal would move ahead the remedy process more quickly and more expeditiously, he suggested in his decision that his decision be appealed to a higher court. And that appeal was made, and it now stands before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which meets in Cincinnati. But at the same time, the Cleveland Board of Education took one further step not contemplated by Judge Battisti, in that they went to a federal judge in the Akron area, and they received from him a stay order, which stayed any movement towards establishing remedies, towards bringing into being certain remedies to correct the situations for which they had been found liable, until the Sixth Circuit Court shall have ruled on the facts and on Judge Battisti's decision. The NAACP has challenged that stay order, and that challenge is before the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeal. The experts are somewhat confounded that that stay order has not been acted on. This is the first case in which a stay order was granted and not reversed. Usually the process of constructing a remedy is allowed to go forward even while the appeal is being heard. But for whatever reason, there is now for a moment a pause, a hiatus. The pause, the experts believe, will be short-lived. In his decision, and this is the second part of this case, Judge Battisti ordered that the interested parties and others who might be interested should bring before his court, to a master whom he would appoint, their recommendations for the ways in which the particular findings of liability might be reversed and positive action taken to reform, to refashion the administrative patterns of the Cleveland school system. 90 days is not a long time. A local attorney was appointed to act as the master. It's my understanding that both the NAACP and the Board of Education have developed plans which they are prepared to submit, and the 90 days has now been extended for as long as it will take for the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to rule on this decision. When it does, and if the pattern holds as it is held in all other cases, the rumor will probably be that Judge Battisti will be affirmed on the facts, and the process of constructing remedies will therefore have to proceed. There is yet no case in the United States where a local district court acting on facts such as these has been reversed in his decision, finding a school board liable. Now, once the finding has been made and we come to the question of remedy, that's when the shoe begins to pinch on the community. And that's when political forces begin to be set at work, and you hear all the tirades one side or another. And I think it's important for all of us to recognize what the school system must deal with, why the NAACP brought the case, and what the likely consequences for the school system and for all of us may be. I think it's first important to recognize that though we're dealing with the schools, and though there's been a great deal of rhetoric introduced in all of these discussions over the last 6 or 7 years as segregational patterns in the North have been under attack, the real issue is not the city school system. The real issue is really not what makes for good education, though obviously that becomes a major part of the discussion and of the remedy. The real issue is a political one. The NAACP, as we now know, went through long days of wrangling before it was decided here in Cleveland to bring this case, because they knew as well as anyone else that the Board of Education is not the black enemy who must be attacked, that it was moving in a certain direction. But it was moving a little bit too slowly, the pace was too slow, and more than this, they were frustrated in their ability to achieve what they really want to achieve, which is an integrated society. A society where the patterns of visible and invisible patterns of racial apartheid, segregation, would begin to disappear. I remember shortly after the decision came down, one member of the black community said to me, "You know, once we're able to place black children in all of the schools of the metropolitan Cleveland area, we'll be able to find housing for black families in all of the school districts of the metropolitan Cleveland area." And that's really a large part of what's behind this. Lacking other tools to attack those patterns of discrimination which appear in housing, which are described under the term white flight, which explained for the black why when he gets himself out of the center city and begins to find housing, more decent housing in some of the suburban areas. Somehow, inevitably, around him, a new black ghetto develops. He somehow never escapes into the larger society. He never finds that equality of openness and opportunity which he believes the Constitution guarantees to him. And he's determined to break that pattern, even though there may be some convulsion. He knows, as well as the school board, that there's a high price to pay. Busing must be financed. Obviously, the tax base of the Cleveland school system will be eroded. Obviously, the white flight will be intensified. There'll be less white children in the school. He knows, as well as any of us, that the evidence of increased educational achievement in integrated schools is not overwhelming. There's a great deal of debate of what the figures mean, but certainly when you simply transfer poor black students to poor white areas and poor white students to poor black areas, it's very clear now that there's no increase in the educational achievements of either group. There may be some achievement when you move poor black or white children into middle class or upper middle class black or white areas, but even that evidence is not very conclusive. But what he also knows, and the reason the case was brought, is that somehow the shoe must pinch on the community before the community will come to grips with the whole reality, the ugly reality of racial apartheid, of racial division, of racial separation and distance as it exists in Cleveland, Detroit, and elsewhere. He has very few other legal recourses at the moment. And part of the tragedy of this case and cases like it is that he really doesn't have the legal recourse he would like. In the case that was brought in Detroit, which is called Bradley versus Milliken, a case that was brought some 3 years ago before Federal District Judge Roth, an attempt was made by Judge Roth in his finding to devise a remedy which would involve the transportation of children not only within the school district of the city of Detroit, but from that Detroit school district to a number of nearby suburban school systems. Obviously, if you transpose that to Cleveland, if it was possible to deal with schools that exist just on the border of the city of Cleveland, East Cleveland and South Euclid and the other Heights areas, it might be possible to devise transportation and sort of revise some lines that you wouldn't be talking about transportation of children, especially elementary school children, across great districts. But Judge Roth was struck down by the United States Supreme Court on the grounds that school districts had a validity in and of their own, and that until the school districts, each of them, was found liable in the courts of having failed to take affirmative action to remove this age-old pattern of racial apartheid and discrimination, they could not be made parties to the remedy. They had to be parties to the suit, found liable before they could be parties to the remedy. Now, the problem with that, when you transpose it to Cleveland, is this. It would be impossible for the NAACP to take the Parma Board of Education before the courts and charge them with discrimination, failure to act to desegregate their school systems. There's simply no black children in the Parma School District, and the Parma School District has never, never discriminated against a black child. It's never had a chance to, and there are none. And it's the seventh largest school district in the state of Ohio. There are 32 school districts in Greater Cleveland, in the metropolitan area. 21 of these have no black children at all in them. So it's impossible for the, given the way the law is now being understood, it is impossible for the NAACP or any other group to bring these 21 school districts before the court and charge them with de facto discrimination. They haven't discriminated. You couldn't find a single instance to prove your case. So they have to begin with the city of Cleveland. And then hopefully, and this is obviously why the Ohio Board of Education was brought in, and clearly Judge Battisti understood the purpose, hopefully they'll find some overarching agency which has responsibility for all of the schools of an area or all the schools of the state, charge it, find it liable, and force it to take certain actions. The most important part of Judge Battisti's decision, I suspect, in the long run, was his finding vis-a-vis the State Board of Education. He described the State Board of Education, which has great powers. According to Judge Battisti, the State Board of Education has the power to redraw school district lines. And according to Judge Battisti, it has the power to withhold state and federal monies from school districts which do not conform to its established principles. Now, the State Board of Education has never acted in Ohio with this kind of power in any area, much less in the area of desegregation, of integration. And it is also true that in the state of Ohio, the Ohio Board of Education is a creature, a child of our legislature, and the legislature could easily redefine, narrow its powers if it wanted to. But clearly, both the NAACP and Judge Battisti are reaching out as best they can to find some supervening authority which can impose some kind of remedy on the situation, which would be larger than simply the city of Cleveland itself. Whether they will succeed is another matter. It's not clear. It's not clear at all that they will. So what we're left with is a situation which is going to be difficult and hopefully not tragic. We're left with a city where 99% of the black children live on the east side and 92% of the white children live on the west side. We're left with a city of Cleveland where not only is east and west separate, but there's a mile or two of industrial commercial no man's land between these two areas. We're left with a school system which is today 57% black and 43% white, and where the percentage of black students is increasing every year, the percentage of white students decreasing every year. How one, given the realities of Cleveland and the limitations of the court decision as it now stands, constructs an effective pattern of transportation, redistricting, and whatnot, is going to be obviously a very, very difficult and I suspect a very expensive solution. And I suspect that it will be one which will be attacked from all sides because of the number of hours that children will be on buses, the cost of the thing, the precipitation of white flight, the obvious fact, which is going to be true, that since we're dealing with a center city system, we're simply transporting street kids who are black to the street areas of white kids and white street kids into other areas. We're dealing with the culturally deprived, educationally the least advantaged. And very little, I think, can be expected to happen educationally. But I don't think that the NAACP really looked for much to happen educationally. What they're looking for is some way of shaking this area and all areas awake to the continuing existence of real social distance, racial distance in our community. And they want to find ways so that black families can live in all parts of the community and black children can integrate socially and recreationally and in every other way into all areas of the youth life of our community. We're in for a difficult time, clearly. We're in for a time which is going to be frustrating for everyone because no one has much to gain. The NAACP will win a remedy, but that remedy will not yet achieve that which it's really striving to achieve. The school system is going to be saddled with very difficult problems, often problems which put them on the horns of a dilemma. On the one hand, they're being told that they must send black and white teachers out indiscriminately without concern for their race to all the communities. At the same time, educators are telling them about the importance of black models in black schools. And at the same time, they know something about the difficulty, particularly at the high school level, that white teachers have in getting through to black teachers and black teachers have in getting through to white students. There are going to be any number of frustrations and very real problems which are going to have to be faced. But I think if we can remember that what is at issue here is a vision of an America which is one of equal justice and equal opportunity, and this is part of the stumbling towards that vision, the inevitable price that you have to pay in order to move ahead, perhaps we can keep our balance and recognize that this is part of a process. It's not the end. It's the beginning of a long process. and recognize that the solution, when one comes, if one can in fact come, is going to involve the whole area and not just the city of Cleveland, then I think we can recognize that there's an opportunity here. An opportunity which, up till now, our community has tended to turn away from. We talk glibly of Cleveland being a community. In fact, it is not. It's a group of people who happen to live in the same area. There's very little which is truly community in Cleveland. But now, for the first time, there's going to be a responsibility, an urgency, a need for people from the east side and from the west side, from the suburbs and from the center city, from all classes, to come together as parents and as citizens, to work together to help solve a very, very complex and difficult human problem. I've already seen the possibilities that this kind of need can have for us in, let's say, the religious community. This whole question has brought together the religious leadership of Cleveland, Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish, in a way that they've never been brought together before in any issue. For the first time, the Catholic bishop has opened his office and his doors to those of other faiths, and at the highest levels, we've sat down and we've worked together to see what we could do to help knit together a community which seems to be coming unraveled. There are all kinds of opportunities. Think of what can be done if we could find what districts are going to be paired and get the parents of one district and the parents of the other district to come together and to meet, so that their children who are going to be bused one way or the other know that there's some homes where they can get a sandwich, or if they have to lie down, they can go and lie down, that there's someone there who can be called to be given information. As soon as the school pairing programs are announced, the churches and the synagogues, parishes of Cleveland, are going to get together to try and establish precisely such a pairing of relationships, some getting together, some getting to know. There are all kinds of possibilities here, if we accept the challenge for what it is, a challenge to our basic sense of the direction and the drift of our democracy, and a challenge to our basic responsibilities as citizens. I could list, as well as any of you, a whole list of educational problems which will arise because of what's called forced busing. And I could list, as well as anybody, a whole list of studies which have been made which shows that there may be very little educational advantage in this kind of integrated activity. There's no trick to that. And I think that one ought to recognize these facts. But I also know that if a democracy is ultimately going to grow and survive and sustain itself, it has to find ways to outgrow old and no longer acceptable patterns of human relationships. And at the moment, the challenge is in the area of the schools and the challenge of affirmative action to desegregate the schools. It's a challenge to our citizenship. It's a challenge to our patience. It's a challenge to our humanity. And I hope and pray that Cleveland will be equal to that challenge. Amen.